information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care. And it shows.
The law?
The country.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Lied to by
the government. They were innocent. They have no idea what they're up against.
Oh my God! Welcome to the final episode of 2007 of Media Monarchy. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you live every Friday from the Portland Radio Authority and also from the Revere Radio Network. This show is going to be a mind-bender. It's going to be a miracle if I can get through all the horrible news. Hoover and habeas corpus and vast biometric databases, more on the torture tapes, more from Northcom and Lockerbie and National Archives and National Treasure, Homeland Security indoctrinating the 9/11 generation, final mass at Ground Zero, Operation Falcon, airport profilers, the most corrupt politicians of 2007, Bill Kristol, Lakota Indians, MI6, it's all here, of course, the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. It's all here on episode 56 of MediaMonarchy.com.
Happy holiday. Happy holiday. May the calendar keep ringing happy holidays to you.
Bing Crosby, Beef Wellington remix, Happy Holidays. That's about as cheery as it's going to get on this episode 56 of Media Monarchy. Coming to you December 28th, 2007 from Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and from the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. And you can hit me up on MySpace and Yahoo and Facebook and all that with Media Monarchy as your keyword, as well as iTunes, radioforall.net, and archive.org. And so I think, hopefully, it looks like I picked up maybe a few more listeners. So hopefully you're back again, and I thank you and appreciate it. And that's what keeps me doing it. I don't know if it's for better or worse, but you've got cracked out, James. I've worked all night. It's that year-end inventory. And there's tons of news to go over, and let's see what we can do. Pakistani former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has been assassinated in a suicide attack. Ms. Bhutto, the first woman prime minister in an Islamic state, was leaving an election rally in Rawalpindi when a gunman shot her in the neck and set off a bomb. At least 16 other people died in the attack and several more were injured. This is coming from the breaking news of BBC yesterday. And I'm sure some of these facts and figures have changed a little bit. President Pervez Musharraf condemned the killing and urged people to remain calm, but angry protests have gripped cities across the country. Security forces have been placed on a state of, quote, red alert nationwide, and they just got out of martial law, and now they're back into it. There were no immediate claims of responsibility for the attack. Analysts believe Islamist militants to be the most likely group behind it. That would be Al-Qaeda. Ms. Bhutto, leader of the Pakistan People's Party, had served as prime minister from 88 to 90 and 93 to 96 and had been campaigning ahead of elections due on January 8th. It was the second suicide attack against her in recent months and came amid a wave of bombings targeting security and government officials. Nawaz Sharif, also a former prime minister and a political rival, announced his Muslim League party would boycott the elections. He called on President Musharraf to resign, saying free and fair elections were not possible under his rule. The United Nations Security Council has begun emergency consultations on the killing.
There were scenes of chaos and panic after the attack just outside the park in Rawalpindi. Amid the confusion, it was unclear at first what the extent and number of the casualties were. But it soon became apparent that a suicide bomber had struck at the Bhutto entourage just outside the park exit as the former Prime Minister was leaving the meeting. Many of the casualties were police and bodyguards, the inner security circle whose job it is to put themselves between the politician and any threat. This was just the latest in a series of public rallies Ms. Bhutto had held in the build-up to next month's election. It was only after she finished speaking and was leaving that her cordon of security was penetrated by the bomber. Ironically, the election was only approved after intense pressure on President Musharraf to lift the state of emergency and to step down as leader of the army. This is the last picture of Benazir Bhutto alive, taken just before her assailant got close enough to blow up her vehicle. The camera then shows the vehicle in flames. First reports said that Ms. Bhutto had survived the attack. The announcement of her death sent her supporters into spasms of grief. Earlier in Islamabad, three people were killed at a separate rally for Ms. Bhutto's longtime rival, Nawaz Sharif. But there's not thought to be any connection between the two attacks. Later, Mr. Sharif sent his condolences to Ms. Bhutto's family and supporters.
It is not a sad day, it is a gloomiest day in the history of this country. Something unthinkable.
Pakistan has been plagued by political violence for much of its 60-year history. As the streets of Rawalpindi flickered tonight with the flames of protest by anguished Bhutto supporters, the question is, will the election go ahead? And if so, can it bring some much-needed stability to the tormented politics of Pakistan and the region? Jim Fish, BBC News.
Now get a load of this from beyond the grave. Benazir Bhutto, in an email sent in October, to a confidant in the U.S. 2 months ago, assassinated Pakistani opposition leader Benazir Bhutto said she would hold the country's current leader, Pervez Musharraf, responsible.
But in death, Bhutto is casting blame for her assassination on President Musharraf. Let's get to our exclusive report now on Bhutto's grim warning of what might happen to her and why. Her fears of an assassination have now come true. And only now can I reveal to you what I know. This is a story she wanted me to tell the world on her behalf if she were killed. This past October, Bhutto sent an email to her longtime friend in Washington, her U.S. spokesman, Mark Siegel. Addressing the danger she faced in her homeland, Bhutto wrote these words, and let me quote them precisely. "Nothing will, God willing, happen. Just wanted you to know, if it does, in addition to the names in my letter to Musharraf of October 16th, I would hold Musharraf responsible. I have been made to feel insecure by his minions, and there is no way what is happening in terms of stopping me from taking private cars or using tinted windows or giving jammers or four police mobiles to cover all sides could happen without him." At Bhutto's request, Mark Siegel forwarded that email to me the day he received it, back on October 26th. But he told me I could not report on it unless Bhutto was killed. In a moment, we'll get reaction from Pakistan's ambassador to the United States. Ambassador Durrani is standing by live. But let's get to the man who received that email from Benazir Bhutto, Mark Siegel, who sent it off to me. Mark, thanks very much for coming in. I know you and Benazir Bhutto were close for 25 years. You had a longstanding relationship with her. My deepest condolences to you on the death of your friend. But give us the context of this email that you received from her. This was 2 months ago.
Benazir was very concerned by the lack of security that she had on her arrival in Karachi on October 18th. The circumstances around the assassination attempt on the night of 18th, the morning of the 19th, was very, very suspicious. There was no investigation, contrary to anything the ambassador might later say. There was no investigation of that horrendous killing, which killed 179 people.
But let's go back again to the day before yesterday, to the 26th, the day before Bhutto's assassination. There's a post up by William Arkin on his early warning blog on WashingtonPost.com. U.S. troops head to Pakistan, or rather, I'm sorry, U.S. troops to head to Pakistan. Beginning early next year, U.S. Special Forces are expected to vastly expand their presence in Pakistan as part of an effort to train and support indigenous counterinsurgency forces and clandestine counterterrorism units. This according to defense officials involved with the planning. So there you have the day before, the Washington Post saying, yeah, we're probably going to get more involved in Pakistan, as if we're not already. Jumping to globalresearch.ca, Jeremy Page wrote, "Who killed Benazir Bhutto? The main suspects." The main suspects in Bhutto's assassination are the Pakistani and foreign Islamist militants who saw her as a heretic and an American stooge and had repeatedly threatened to kill her. But fingers will also be pointed at Inter-Services Intelligence, the Pakistani ISI, the agency that has had close ties to the Islamists since the 70s and has been used by successive Pakistani leaders to suppress political opposition. Now, that article goes on, but all you got to say is who taught them how to suppress opposition. There's a lot more, and I'm sure there's even more that's come out since I put these posts together to bring in to do the show, and it's all there on MediaMonarchy.com, where we're going to trudge forward, jump into thetelegraph.co.uk. Britain in secret talks with the Taliban. Agents from MI6 entered secret talks with Taliban leaders despite Gordon Brown's pledge that Britain would not negotiate with terrorists. Officers from the Secret Intelligence Service staged discussions known as Jirgas, and there's a link you can read about that, with senior insurgents on several occasions over the summer. An intelligence source said, quote, "The SIS officers were understood to have sought peace directly with the Taliban, with them coming across as some sort of armed militia. The British would also provide mentoring for the Taliban." Now, similarly, and I haven't quite figured out what the difference is here, but I got one report that says MI6 is talking to the Taliban, and then another one that says the UN admits to talks with anti-government forces in Afghanistan. This coming from BBC, they report that the United Nations has been in on the act as well.
The United Nations has admitted to the BBC that it's been talking to anti-government figures in Afghanistan. A spokesman said it was the only way to try to stabilize parts of the country. The comments follow the decision of the Afghan government to expel two high-ranking officials. Alistair Leithead sent us this report from Kabul.
It was here in Musa Qala, in Helmand province, that a meeting with tribal elders appears to have got the two high-ranking political advisers into trouble. One arm of the Afghan government knew they were going, another seemingly didn't. They were accused of talking to the Taliban.
They were involved in some activities that were not their jobs, and those activities were a threat for Afghanistan national security.
But talking to the insurgents does go on, depending on how you define the Taliban. Just the religious extremists? Or what about the tribal chiefs who back them and could be persuaded to support the government?
If we are to ensure that we can cement peace for the people of the Helmand province, and that means talking to all people on the ground, including those who are perhaps not as favourable towards the government of Afghanistan as we would all like them to be.
It's a well-accepted fact here that the insurgency cannot be beaten through military means alone. The fighting is just one part of the equation. Working out how the tribal map of places like Helmand goes is vital, and that means making contact with all sorts of different people.
It seems the time for diplomacy has run out. With President Karzai and many of his ministers now in Pakistan, it seems likely that the two men will leave Afghanistan in accordance with the wishes of the Afghan government. But negotiations will continue in an effort to try and see the return of two of the most well-respected and knowledgeable members of the international community here. Alistair Leithead, BBC News, Kabul.
There's further evidence of the dance that goes on between the intelligence services of the quote-unquote first world with all the tribal, cleric, sectarian of the third world. Who's pulling whose strings? That's the question. But let's keep moving. Coming from Raw Story, one of the bigger stories as well of the last week or so, descendants of Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse break away from the U.S. The Lakota Indians, who gave the world legendary warriors Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse, among many, many others, have withdrawn from treaties with the United States. Quote, "We are no longer citizens of the United States of America, and all those who live in the five-state area that encompasses our country are free to join us." That was said by longtime Indian rights activist Russell Means, and he was telling that to a handful of reporters and a delegation from the Bolivian embassy, and they were gathered in a church in the rundown neighborhood of Washington for a news conference last week. A delegation of Lakota leaders delivered a message to the State Department last Monday announcing they were unilaterally withdrawing from treaties they signed with the federal government of the United States. Some of them are more than 150 years old. They also visited the Bolivian, Chilean, South African, and Venezuelan embassies and will continue on their diplomatic mission and take it overseas in the coming weeks and months. Lakota country includes parts of the states of Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming. The new country would issue its own passports and driver's license, and living there would be tax-free, provided residents renounce their U.S. citizenship. Now, Russell Means, the longtime Indian rights activist, RussellMeans.com, did an interview on Free Talk Live, and so we're going to listen to a couple minutes of that, Russell Means of the Lakota Indians.
And we're going to start things out tonight, though, with a guest. Last week, we brought you a story that I mean, this might have been the story of the year, brought you a story about the Lakota Indian tribe and how they're essentially seceding from the United States. Now, that's as I understand it. Maybe I've got the term wrong. I don't know. We had lots of questions when we brought this up originally, and I said, you know, I'm going to do my best to get Russell Means. He is he is one of the men behind this secession. He's also a libertarian. He's an activist, and he's actually an actor as well. Wayne, you may remember him from Last of the Mohicans, yes, as a matter of fact. We have Russell on the line with us, and Russell, welcome to Free Talk Live. Do we have Russell?
All of you.
Hi there. So, where are you calling us from tonight?
I'm in just east of Santa Fe in a little Mexican village called San Jose. It's my wife's house, and we live here part-time out of the year.
Understood. Now, last week, the news broke about the Lakota Indian tribe essentially seceding from the United States. Is that basically what's happening? Can you put that into your own words to explain to our listeners what exactly is going on?
Well, first of all, we're not a tribe. Nations make treaties. Tribes do not. And it's not a cessation from the United States of America. It's just reestablishing our independence and freedom guaranteed by the United States of America in Article 6 of the Constitution.
So I guess it couldn't possibly be a secession because you aren't one of the 50 states. You never joined the Union, so therefore you couldn't possibly secede from it.
Exactly. Now, what we did was we unilaterally withdrew from all agreements and treaties with the United States of America for their blatant disregard and illegal breaking of those treaties and agreements, and we reestablished legally, both through national law and international law, that we are a free and independent country.
That's Russell Means of the Lakota Indians, and all the pertinent research links are there for you up on MediaMonarchy.com. Whipping around at breakneck speed, we're going to get into some of the latest on Ron Paul, 2008.com. And first, we're going to hit up another CNN clip, old Wolfie, old APAC Wolf. He had Ron Paul on yesterday, as I'm sure all the campaign trailers all were talking about the Bhutto assassination. However, let's get the distinctive take from Ron Paul.
The Republican presidential candidate, Congressman Ron Paul, is joining us now from Des Moines, Iowa. Congressman, thanks very much for joining us. Clearly, there are enormous stakes, interests for the United States. Pakistan is a Muslim country. There's an Al-Qaeda presence there. Osama bin Laden is believed to be hiding out there. There's a resurgent Taliban, a lot of sympathizers to these extremists in Pakistan. And this is a country that already has a nuclear arsenal. If you were president, Congressman, right now, what would you do?
I would try to change the policy so that we were less involved in their internal affairs. I've complained about the policy with Pakistan for a good many years. We've been giving them billions of dollars. They've got about $10 billion over the last 8 years. So we've aligned ourselves with a military dictator who overthrew an elected government. And he was supposed to help us find Osama bin Laden. That hasn't helped. So it was a bad investment. And it also elicits concern about our puppet governments. Musharraf is seen as one of our puppets. There's a group over there, the Al-Qaeda is growing because they don't like us to have puppet governments over there, and they love chaos. So I can see where the support that we've given Musharraf has been indirectly involved in this. It's a mess.
So what would you do specifically, Congressman, right now if you were dealt this hand as President of the United States?
I would treat them like another country. They're in a civil war. I wouldn't get involved in the civil war. It's what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't be sending troops over there. I wouldn't be sending them any more money. I would try to talk to people who come out. When they sort it out, they should and urge that they have self-determination and that they go back to a sensible approach. But for us to be involved militarily or send our CIA in there to overthrow one government versus another, I've already heard, well, let's get rid of Musharraf. We've staked it out with him, and it isn't working, so we want to get rid of him. Let's put somebody else in charge. Just more of the same stuff that we have been doing for so many years. It's time we look for non-intervention and stay out of these conflicts and let them sort it out themselves.
So basically what I hear you saying, if you were president, you would say, you know what, Musharraf, it's all yours. Do whatever you want. We're getting out of there. No more billions in U.S. military assistance. No more intelligence cooperation. No more nothing. Is that right?
That would be a good policy. Besides, we don't have the money anyway. We either have to steal it from the American people or print the money or borrow it from China. And so we're going broke, and so we can just start right now by stopping this. Of course, the whole Middle East has been my argument that we just can't afford this anymore.
Would you at all be
it doesn't help us.
Would you at all be concerned, Congressman, about a Taliban-like or Al-Qaeda-like Islamic fundamentalist regime taking charge of Pakistan with a nuclear arsenal already? They're not thinking about building nuclear bombs. They already have nuclear bombs.
Yeah, and I think because we supported a military dictator and he became our puppet, we've actually enhanced that opportunity for him. So, yes, I'm concerned, but I'm concerned about the leftover nuclear weapons in the Soviet, from the old Soviet system in Central Asia. There are some of those weapons that haven't been accounted for. So, yes, we have concern, but I'm concerned about the Taliban resurgence in Afghanistan. Our policies aren't working all that well. They're having major victories over there, and there's more killing. They're asking for more of our troops to go into Afghanistan. I'm just saying enough is enough. We shouldn't be doing this. We get ourselves into too many messes, and we ought to mind our own business and take care of our people here at home.
Well, you have a new ad that's running now. It's called The Defender of Freedom. Your ad that's showing how you want to protect freedom, protect liberty, what you call our God-given freedom. What global responsibilities, if you were president, should the United States have? Does the U.S. have a role around the world?
Sure it does. It should be friends with people. We should trade with people. We should try to sort things out diplomatically. But we don't have the moral authority or the constitutional authority to impose our will. We shouldn't be either bribing them with our donations and foreign aid, and we shouldn't be threatening them. If they don't do what we want, we bomb them. I'm offering something different, something the Founding Fathers offered, and that is neutrality. Talk to people and trade with people and negotiate with people, but not to have these two choices of either subsidizing them with foreign aid or threatening them with violence if they don't do as we tell them.
All right. Then next, the New York Times had to post a little retraction about a story they ran about Ron Paul. There's been all this sort of racist smear garbage, so a post in The Medium, that's another blog, this one on the New York Times, a post in The Medium that appeared on Monday about the Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul and his purported adoption by white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups contained several errors. Stormfront, which describes itself as a white nationalist internet community, did not give money to Ron Paul's presidential campaign. This according to Jesse Benton, spokesman for Paul's campaign. It was Don Black, the founder of the group, and he gave $500 to Paul. So the original post had assertions of them meeting together and doing all kinds of things together and yada, yada, yada. And there's a link up to Stormfront White Nationalist Community up on Wikipedia. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. And it's got Don Black and all that garbage in there. Moving on, however, Denmark-based Saxo Bank, that's S-A-X-O, Saxo Bank predicts Ron Paul's going to win the presidency, but the U.S. economy will plunge into a depression prior to that election. The bank predicted that Ron Paul, U.S. Congressman and Republican presidential candidate, will win the U.S. 2008 presidential election. Saxo Bank says the U.S. economy will shrink by 25% and the Chinese economy will decrease by 40%. The economic downturn will come about as a result of the housing crash, of course. Ron Paul has been critical of the Federal Reserve and has blamed the Federal Reserve for causing the real estate bubble and crash. Paul has said that the loose monetary policy of the Fed has artificially inflated real estate prices, which led to the collapse. Paul supports sound money and opposes the Federal Reserve's inflation tax and says that he wants to prevent a dollar collapse. Saxo Bank also predicts a $175 barrel of oil and the price of grain will double. Some have predicted that oil will climb to $250 a barrel if the U.S. attacks Iran. And the bank also predicts that 30% of large building companies will go bankrupt. Sound money in economics is a concept defined by Deardorff's Glossary of International Economics as, quote, a currency that is responsibly managed so as to avoid excessive inflation. That's when you print up more money than you have to back it up. Inflation tax is a metaphor for the economic disadvantage suffered by holders of cash and cash equivalents in one denomination of currency due to the effects of inflation, which acts as a hidden tax that subtracts value from those assets. Among the negative effects of inflation tax is that it affects the middle and lower classes the most. Imagine that. Now, there's a few clips. I don't think I have time to get into them, and I don't really even feel like it. But LouRockwell.com has the posting in the video of Trotskyite William Kristol of the Weekly Standard, Neocon, PNAC, all that. He went on television, I don't know if it was CNN or Fox or whatever, but he basically went on and called Ron Paul a crackpot. But the LouRockwell.com posting says that this video is a great demonstration of what neoconservatives believe in: the warfare, welfare, corporate, police state, and global hegemony. Other countries better like it or we'll destroy them, and no one better question the shifting rationale since we have always been at war with Islamic East Asia. Crystal is horrified that Ron Paul wants to question some of the past and current practices of the biggest government in the history of the world, to call us away from empire and the corporate state and to our constitutional Republican origins. And note Crystal's identification of the American nation with the central government. To be anti-American is to disagree with social welfare spending, corporate welfare spending, and Pentagon spending. Ron Paul, whom Crystal also calls a crank, and yada, yada, yada. And that goes on. And there's the link up, and you can read about William Crystal and, yeah, the Weekly Standard, and co-founder of Project for a New American Century, and he's the son of Irving Crystal. Now, I think we'll get into this at some point, but, of course, you know, the PNAC document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, that said we need to be a nation-building empire. That's going to be really hard to do unless we maybe have some catastrophic catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, and god damn it, wouldn't you know it, they got it. So the other one that got a lot of traction, Ron Paul was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert last Sunday, and that was a long one. I think the entire video is 41 minutes. Kurt Nemo has the article up, NBC's Russert attempts to portray Ron Paul as a hypocrite and spendthrift. And so they badgered him about earmarks and yada yada, and you can read the Houston Chronicle. And all the other things are there, and I'm just going to blast past it, because we're looking ahead. We're looking to the primaries and the caucuses and everything that's going to kick off next week. Anyway, let's keep moving. Away from, unfortunately, a fantastic congressman and presidential candidate, let's jump to Judicial Watch, judicialwatch.org, and their list of the 10 most wanted corrupt politicians for 2007. And wouldn't you know it, it's the list of all your favorite politicians. And they're in alphabetical order. Here we go. Hillary Clinton. In addition to her long and sordid ethics record, Senator Hillary Clinton took a lot of heat in 2007, and rightly so, for blocking the release of her official White House records. Many suspect these records contain a treasure trove of information related to her role in a number of serious Clinton-era scandals. Moreover, in March 2007, Judicial Watch filed an ethics complaint against Hillary for filing false financial disclosure forms with the U.S. Senate. Again. And Hillary's top campaign contributor, Norman Hsu, HSU, was exposed as a felon and a fugitive from justice. Hsu pleaded guilty to one count of grand theft for defrauding investors as part of a multi-million dollar Ponzi scheme. Up next, John Conyers. And Conyers reportedly repeatedly violated the law and House ethics rules, forcing his staff to serve as his personal servants, babysitters, valets, and campaign workers while on the government payroll. Let's jump to good old Larry Craig, in one of the most shocking scandals of 2007. I wouldn't call it shocking at all. The GOP is into homosexual trysts. Isn't that right, Johnny Gosh? Senator Craig was caught by police attempting to solicit sex in a Minneapolis International Airport men's bathroom during the summer. Let's jump to Dianne Feinstein. She's a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee's Subcommittee on Military Construction, and Feinstein reviewed military construction government contracts, some of which were ultimately awarded to URS Corporation and Perini, companies then owned by, wouldn't you know it, Diane's husband, Richard Blum, B-L-U-M. While the Pentagon ultimately awards military contracts, there is a reason for the review process. And it's for people like that to hand out no-bid contracts to their spouses and lovers and cronies and thugs. Speaking of thugs, up next, number five on the list is Rudolph Giuliani, son of a bat-wielding mob boss. Yeah, not a mob boss. He's a thug. Giuliani came under fire in late 2007 after it was discovered the former New York mayor's office, quote, billed obscure city agencies for tens of thousands of dollars in security expenses amassed during a time when he was beginning an extramarital relationship with future wife Judith Nathan in the Hamptons. Mike Huckabee, Governor Huckabee of Arkansas, following in a fine tradition of Arkansas governors, he enjoyed a meteoric rise in the polls in December, which we're in, which we're trying to get through, which prompted a more thorough review of his ethics records. According to the Associated Press, Huckabee's career has been colored by 14 ethics complaints and a volley of questions about his integrity, ranging from management of campaign cash to his use of a nonprofit organization to subsidize his income for his destruction of state computer files on his way out of the governor's office. How do you like that? And we got more on him later. Scooter Libby, former chief of staff to Darth Cheney, was sentenced to 30 months in prison and fined $250,000 for lying and obstructing the Valerie Plame CIA leak investigation. Up next, at number 8, is your favorite Barack Obama. A dishonorable mention last year, Senator Obama moves into the top 10 for 2007. In 2006, however, it was discovered that Obama was involved in a suspicious real estate deal with an indicted political fundraiser, Antoine Tony Rezko, R-E-Z-K-O. In 2007, more reports surfaced of deeper and suspicious business and political connections. It was reported that just 2 months after he joined the Senate, Obama purchased $50,000 worth of stock in speculative companies whose major investors were his biggest campaign contributors. One of the companies was a biotech concern that benefited from legislation Obama pushed just 2 weeks after the senator purchased 5,000 of the company's shares. Obama was nabbed conducting campaign business in his Senate office, which is a violation of federal law. Number 9. Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker, promised a new era of ethics enforcement in the White House, or rather in the House of Representatives. She snuck a $25 million gift to her husband, Paul Pelosi, in a $15 billion Water Resources Development Act recently passed by Congress. This pet project involved renovating ports in Speaker Pelosi's home base of San Francisco. Pelosi just happens to own apartment buildings near the areas targeted for improvement and will almost certainly experience a significant boost in property value as a result of Pelosi's earmark. Earlier in the year, Pelosi found herself in hot water for demanding access to a luxury Air Force jet to ferry the Speaker and her entourage back and forth from San Fran nonstop in an unprecedented request, which was wisely rejected by the Pentagon. And under Pelosi's leadership, the House ethics process remains essentially shut down, which protects members in both parties from accountability. You see how that works? Finally, number 10, Senator Harry Reid. Over the last few years, Reid has been embroiled in a series of scandals that cast serious doubts on his credibility as a self-professed champion of government ethics. According to the LA Times, over the last 4 years, Reid has used his influence in Washington to help a developer, Havy Whittemore, clear obstacles for profitable real estate deals. And those are the people you're looking to for a big change in 2008. So, looking back at 2007 once again, Gwen Ifill of PBS's Washington Week did a quick rundown, and here's a quick clip from that rundown.
It seemed only the thing to do at this time of year to provide our loyal viewers with a little additional gift. No, we're not really done. We're going to give you the thoughts, the observations, and analysis of Washington Week panelists who have been covering the stories that matter. We couldn't fit them all around the table here, so I chatted with them over the last few weeks. First up, 2008 politics.
What we're seeing is a great deal of dissatisfaction bordering on disgust with the political process, with the way Washington works, with both political parties. You hear it and you see it almost everywhere you go. The frustration that Washington isn't working, the sense that the polarized politics that we've had for the last decade or more have certainly done an ill service to the country. And I think a question of, is there a candidate out there, or will this election in any way break out of that cycle and put us into a new place?
There has been no preseason for this campaign, I think in part because
It's the most wide open race, the first race since 1928 where there hasn't been an heir apparent of an incumbent president or vice president on either side. All the states have moved their primaries up early in a stampede, so all of the candidates have had to raise more money than would have seemed even possible a few years ago. We have almost as many candidates still in the race at the end of the year as we had at the beginning of the year.
If you talk to voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, and other places, they really aren't sure who to vote for on the Democratic side or on the Republican side. The distinctions between Senator Clinton, Senator Obama, and former Senator John Edwards, and all the other Democrats on health care, for example, are really very small.
On the Republican side, I think there's a much greater level of concern. But I think both sides know, I think voters on both sides believe it, and certainly the candidates believe it, that we're heading for a very big election. And this is a country that's certainly ready for some kind of a change. The question is exactly what kind of a change is that?
People want change, but they don't want risk. And so they may take a look at Barack Obama and say, you know, he's terrific, he's great. Does he have the experience? And so in the Democratic side, it's going to be a question of experience and judgment.
I think this has been, in many ways, the most fascinating campaign that I've been able to cover, and that dates back some years.
All right, that full clip is up there, but we're going to move on to an article by Mike Whitney, posted up on the peoplesvoice.org. It's called The Butcher's Apron. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's a pretty scathing intro there. It's also on Online Journal. Every 4 years, the country is swept up in the pomp and pageantry of presidential elections, and every 4 years, loyal Americans flock to the voting booths to select the candidate of their choice. Elections, we are told, are the true expression of a democratic government, but they aren't. They're a sham, and most people know it. The balloting creates the illusion of choice where there is none. It's a meaningless ritual that has nothing to do with representative government. And he goes on to mention what we covered last week, and that's ex-Ohio Secretary of State Jennifer Brunner basically saying that the machines are totally hackable, and probably were. Then we're going to jump now to the Pan-African Newswire. They have an article up called Operation Falcon, Police State America in Real Time, in which, at the outset, they reference Mike Whitney, who we just mentioned in his article, The Butcher's Apron. In February of this year, Mike Whitney published an article called Operation Falcon and the Looming Police State, and he won a Project Censored Award for that. In it, he reported that the Bush administration carried out three massive sweeps in the last 2 years, rolling up more than 30,000 minor crooks and criminals that he calls a blueprint for removing dissidents and political rivals, reminiscent of Nazi Germany or any other repressive police state. Those chickens now reside at home, but the public is largely unaware and unconcerned. We all should be, as Whitney raises a red flag for anyone who cares at all about human rights, civil liberties, or simply saving his own skin. Operation Falcon stands for Federal and Local Cops Organized Nationally, and came out of the Bush Justice Department and right-wing think tanks, where fantasies of autocratic government have a long history and are now playing out in real time. The scheme centralizes power in Washington and uses resources of local authorities for its own purposes. And I have that article linked up in its entirety. It's up on informationclearinghouse.info. Operation Falcon and the Looming Police State. It's fantastic. I also have links you can read more about Operation Falcon and who's involved and what they got and all the drugs they seized and all that. Moving to the airport, this from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Airport profilers, they're watching your expressions. If a pair of Transportation Security Administration officers strolling by a SeaTac airport ticket counter wish you happy holidays and ask where you're traveling, it might be more than just Christmas spirit. Travelers at SeaTac, that's Seattle-Tacoma, and dozens of other major airports across America are being scrutinized by teams of TSA behavior detection officers, specially trained to discern the subtlest suspicious behaviors. TSA officials will not reveal specific behaviors identified by the program called SPOT, screening passengers by observation technique, that are considered indicators of possible terrorist intent. So, basically, If you look annoyed that undertrained thugs are giving your grandma shit about the bottle of water she has, and you maybe, you know, express that disgust on your face, that could just mean you're a terrorist and you're with Al-Qaeda. What else we got on the police state front? Oh, yes, this coming from Green Bay, Wisconsin, WBAY.com. Police begin fingerprinting on traffic stops. If you're ticketed by Green Bay police, you'll get more than a fine. You'll get fingerprinted, too. It's a new way police are cracking down on crime. Yeah, it's all crime. All crime is terrorism. If you're caught speeding or playing your music too loud or other crimes for which you might receive a citation, Green Bay police officers will ask for your driver's license and your finger. You'll be fingerprinted right there on the spot. The fingerprint appears right next to the amount of the fine. Police say it's meant to protect you. It's all for your protection. In case the person they're citing isn't who they claim to be, but not everyone is sold on that explanation. The article goes on, and all I'll say is, I know which finger you should give them. Coming from another great blog on Wired.com, I know we always hit up Danger Room a lot for all their private military contractor, future combat system, global information grid, and we'll probably get to some of that. On Beyond the Beyond, that's another one I hadn't really hit up before, angry populace burning British surveillance cameras. And there's lots of gratuitous photos of a group that calls themselves MAD, Motorists Against Detection. They're a vigilante anti-speed camera group, and they've basically been blowing up cameras in the UK, and they basically say they won't stop until you get rid of the surveillance cameras. So there you go. There's a little resistance. I don't know if I would recommend that, but let's jump back to Portland, back to the hometown here, and my man Alex Ansari. I think he's having some computer difficulty, so his episodes are being posted up a little late as of late. But Outside the Box, episode 132 is posted up, and it's on MediaMonarchy.com. And 132's guest was a guy named Derek Jensen, and he discussed his writings and lectures on the problems of modern civilization. I also always link up his Saturday Outside the Box radio show on We the People Radio Network, and we're going to hear some quick clips from both those shows.
Derek Jensen, the problem of civilization and the resistance. Those topics and more are covered in one of his recent books, Endgame, Volume 1 and 2. He's also recently authored a graphic novel called 50 Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial While the World Burns. Derek, are you with us?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Derek, for those that aren't aware of your work, give us an overview of Endgame, for that matter, and the problem of civilization that you've been talking about for several years.
Well, Endgame is really based on the idea, on the question of, do you believe that the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And nobody ever knows says yes. And, you know, I ask people this all over the country, and nobody ever says yes. And the next question is, if you don't believe the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and you care about either the land where you live or life at all, then what does that mean for your strategy and your tactics? And the answer is that for the most part, we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending there's going to be some sort of magical transformation. You know, we believe we spend all this time just sort of hoping that something great is going to happen instead of taking responsibility and acting to defend the places we love.
Just to wrap this up, with our man and machine melding into one transhumanistic movement, that the collective psyche is being driven by the social engineers running the planet. Here we are moving on to our next headline to close to this chapter. Swedish athlete's favorite chip implants. This comes to us from the Inquirer in the UK. A pair of Swedes, Carolyn Kluft and Stephen Holm, have sparked controversy over plans for tagging athletes, which would involve either a chip implant or a permanently carrying around a GPS receiver, either a chip implant or something, pertaining to a GPS receiver. Apparently, the proposal is aimed at tackling the thorny issue of doping, whereby athletes have to predict their whereabouts for the next quarter so that they can be arbitrarily tested. Cliff told the local, "I have previously proposed that we should have computer chips surgically implanted into our skin, but it might just be as good if everybody at a certain level had a key ring with a GPS transmitter on their training bags." When asked for his reaction to the proposal, fellow Swedish athlete Stephen Holm replied, "Why not? He feels carrying a GPS receiver around would be better than being treated with suspicion the entire time. However, he believes for a scheme to work 100%, it would be better for all athletes to have a chip implant. So Big Brother won't just be watching you, he'll be right under your skin." The reality is, what else will the chips of tomorrow be able to detect on some level? When most people aren't even concerned about the surveillance society with cameras by themselves, but for you and I to talk about cameras is passe, because they're everywhere. The question is, what type of cameras are being put up and what can they do? Can they scan their brain? Are they showed in with an international peer database or a national database? Who's using the information? Who's buying it? How much did it cost? How much do they know about you? Do they know about your sexual habits? Do they know about what ticks, what makes you tick? What psychological algorithmic wave are you sending out from your cranium? That's the final frontier. And unless we do a 180 and the systems of control come crashing down, these things are just going to expand. Now, yeah, I don't know how that's going to happen, other than the major global economic decline that they did not necessarily count on or engineer. But the tables truly are turned in our favor. But for these things to stop, for the speed cameras to stop being implanted, installed, set up, put up all over the globe, from Europe to France, different cities and states in the United States, then we're screwed on a certain level, because it's going to expand in new and profound ways that we haven't even thought of yet.
That's my man Alex Ansari, Outside the Box, every week out of here in Portland, Oregon. Moving on, moving forward, CIA man can take White House down. Now, I submitted this to Dig, and I blinked, and all of a sudden it had 2,500 hits. So through the Christmas break, I didn't the traffic to the site kind of dipped, but I I got a lot of hits from that Dig, and of course the DEA, they always visit. And on the comments section on a post on Little Green Footballs, somebody posted a link to the story I had posted up several months ago about basically Daily Kos and Marcus Muliza Zuniga and his past admitted connections to the CIA. Okay, so that brings us right back to CIA man can take White House down. Former head of the CIA's clandestine service, Jose Rodriguez, claims he can take the White House down over a torture cover-up scandal. Rodriguez said he may testify before the House Intelligence Committee if he is granted immunity from prosecution. Intelligence sources believe Rodriguez is now quite determined not to become the fall guy in the controversy over the destruction of CIA videotapes showing the torture of terrorist suspects. The hundreds of hours of videotapes reportedly showed the interrogation of two Al-Qaeda leaders, Abu Zubaydah and Abdi al-Rahim al-Nashiri, all while they were being held in a secret military prison. A former CIA officer has testified that the videotapes showed Zubaydah being subjected to waterboarding, a form of torture that simulates drowning. Despite the Bush administration's denial of any involvement in the destruction of the tapes, the CIA and White House have been accused of torturing detainees in the so-called War on Terror. Now, we link to that source at timesonline.co.uk. CIA chief to drag White House into torture cover-up storm.
Sarah Baxter writes, the CIA chief who ordered the destruction of secret videotapes recording the harsh interrogation of two top al-Qaeda suspects has indicated he may seek immunity from prosecution in exchange for testifying. Let's see if he magically commits suicide or something. The link up on Wikipedia, Jose A. Rodriguez Jr. was the director of the National Clandestine Service of the United States Central Intelligence Agency. He was the last to serve as the agency's deputy director for operations before that position was upgraded in December 2004. Rodriguez's record has recently come under scrutiny after the New York Times reported he authorized the destruction of two 2002 CIA interrogation videotapes. So all those links are there, and you can read more all about that and the guys tortured and how it all basically connects to 9/11. Speaking of 9/11, this coming from monstersandcritics.com, the final Midnight Mass at Ground Zero was held. The first Midnight Mass at Ground Zero was celebrated as workers were still clearing debris from the World Trade Center after 9/11. Increased construction is picking up at the World Trade Center site in New York, as we've discussed, you know, buildings catching on fire and cranes dropping their load and paralyzing people and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, finding body parts and manhole covers and things. The last mass was held Monday night, giving police, firefighters, recovery workers, and victims' families a final chance to pray on Christmas Eve at the site where construction is increasingly taking up open space. A lot of us felt sad this was the last official midnight mass on site, but at the same time, there was a sense of relief this brought closure for us, the Reverend Brian Jordan said early Tuesday after the service ended. A chaplain who spent 10 months at Ground Zero after 9/11, he has since presided over every midnight mass there. CNN reported that 75 people attended the mass. And I have that link, bell tolls on final midnight mass at Ground Zero. 75 people attended, Brian Jordan said, brought closure for all of us. The Port Authority says construction will make it hard to continue that tradition, but Port Authority spokesman says space can be found at the site of 9/11 attacks. Get in your memorial zone, your free speech zone. Moving on, I think on Christmas Day, I only posted up maybe one story, and it was, all we want for Christmas is peace. And there's a nice little comic there for you to check out. The link goes to desertpeace.blogspot.com, and it's an article, In Gaza, Santa is insolvent. Basically says Santa Claus is empty-handed this year. Insolvent. That was said by Father Manuel Musalem, head of the Holy Family School in Gaza City. Moving on, however, back to global research, back to private military contractors, back to future combat systems. Global research and knowledge-driven revolution, Brent Jessup. The Pentagon's electronic warfare program, maximum control of the entire electromagnetic spectrum. In 2003, then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld signed a document called the Information Operation Roadmap, which outlined, among other things, the Pentagon's desire to dominate the entire electromagnetic spectrum. That's a lot to dive into. However, the links are all there for you to read all about the Information Operation Roadmap. And it's a big, massive think tank white paper with lots of great redactions in there that are always trying to, you know, it's fun to try and figure out what they're talking about. Another bit of news from the Pentagon, high-flying spy drones hobbled. This, of course, coming from Danger Room. The Pentagon's highest flying spy drone isn't able to consistently perform, even on a limited schedule. This according to a draft Defense Department report. The Global Hawk Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, UAV, that's what they're talking about. This article basically says they're not working as well as they should. I don't know whether to believe that or not. But all the links are there, and you can read about the Global Hawk and the High Altitude Endurance Unmanned Aerial Vehicle. They're called Block 10s. Jumping to the AP and military.com, Army expansion plans outlined. The Pentagon will send 6 new combat brigades to bases in Texas, Georgia, and Colorado in the coming years as part of an extensive plan to increase the size of the Army. Filled with ex-felons, illegals, gang members, you know. The Pentagon will... I already read that. As the Army moves to grow by 74,000 soldiers by 2010... The officials last week mapped out decisions to add the combat brigades and 8 support units around the country, as well as an agreement to delay moving 2 brigades out of Germany until 2012. Fort Bliss in Texas, Fort Carson in Colorado, and Fort Stewart in Georgia will be big winners, each getting 2 new combat brigades, but every Army installation across the country will see more soldiers, anywhere from a few to thousands. And there's a link up also to the New York Times article on the same thing. Bush approves Army reorganization. They're beefing it up. He, of course, passed the massive, massive, massive spending bill as we beef up the police state. Jumping back again to Kurt Nimmo. Shifting gears a little bit, but we're still under the heading of police state technocracy run amok. This is an interesting one, and I don't get a whole lot into chemtrails and all that, but it is interesting to note when a NBC station out of California does a report on chemtrail weather control.
Tonight, a community in the San Bernardino Mountains has a real mystery on its hands. The official explanation here is that jet contrails are causing strange lines in the sky, and that it's pollen making people sick on the ground. But others are convinced it is something else, and they ask, is the government experimenting with our weather?
There was a huge dust cloud.
Longtime Cedar Glen resident Gretchen Sherman says she has never seen anything like it.
How thick was it?
Oh, it covered the entire Cedar Glen area.
A cloud of dust, leaving a sticky yellow slime all over her car. It happened again last February, and calls began pouring into the local Alpenhorn newspaper.
And they had a tremendous upsurge of children that were not going to school at that time.
Pharmacist Ed Burroughs says it is the most mysterious illness he's seen in 22 years on the mountain.
A lot of eye infection problems, upper respiratory problems, nosebleeds.
The nearby March Air Force Base say it didn't come from them. Others said it was a pollen cloud. The Department of Health found a yellowish tint on a tissue submitted for testing. But, quote, there was no sign of any biological form, such as cedar pollen, and the test was ruled inconclusive. And it wasn't long before things ballooned into a sky-high mystery.
The story is not just here in Crestline in the alleged yellow cloud. People say the government is up there in airplanes spraying all kinds of chemicals to change or manipulate the weather, leaving what you see there, and they call that a chemtrail.
So what I look at there and I think are contrails, you're telling me are chemtrails.
Yes, that a contrail would be dissipated by now.
It would.
Yes, it would.
Chemtrails. On the internet, they are cited as proof of the government creating clouds to combat global warming. In response, the Air Force says that, quote, there is no such thing as a chemtrail. The actual contrails are a safe and natural phenomenon. And that people are seeing more contrails simply because there are more jets forming large clouds, depending on weather conditions. As in this video of alleged chemtrails shot near San Francisco.
I think these are contrails.
Professor Gregory Benford of UC Irvine works with the Department of Energy on weather research.
That's very odd. They could be very large contrails.
He says the DOE doesn't know of any jet spraying chemicals to affect the weather. However, he says we will probably see it in the near future.
You've got to, in a sense, engineer all these so you get the right kind of clouds for the effects we want.
It is called geoengineering, fighting global warming by putting a chemical dust in the atmosphere and reflecting harmful radiation back into space.
You could use barium oxide, for example, which makes big fluffy clouds. You could use tiny little bits of aluminum, which is benign in the environment, and essentially manage the climate.
And what I found was unusual spiking since the early 1990s in barium, aluminum.
Last time I had a look.
But Rosalind Peterson of California Skywatch says health department records show a sharp increase in both chemicals in the water supply of Northern California, dating from the time the huge contrails first appeared over her home in Mendocino County.
What's the significance of the barium and the aluminum?
I went and got all the tests, and all these things in the same test would be up way over state and federal standards. It had to be airborne, because how could it get to such diverse regions of our county? We have jets going in every direction. X's, east, west, north, south, circles. There is something going on the air. I don't know exactly what, but I think there's some experimentation.
Is it legal?
I don't know, because we haven't had a public discussion.
But what is unknown today may be actual fact tomorrow, thanks to a bill soon to be voted on in the U.S. Senate, a Weather Modification Act, calling for research in, quote, attempting to change or control by artificial methods the natural development of atmospheric cloud forms.
Doesn't it seem to you that they're going to be doing it in the future for sure?
Yes. And if they are, I want to know about it.
In the meantime, a lot of people are wondering if they'll ever get clear skies and a clear answer.
The legislation is there. Therefore, somebody's thinking about this. How does this make sense?
I don't know. Maybe they're practicing.
Over Cedar Glen. over Arrowhead.
Okay. I guess you have to try it out before you use it. I'm not sure.
Well, you be the judge. We'll keep you posted on anything further on this story, and there will be more, that's for sure. More information on the weather modification proposals, check on our website, nbc4.tv.
Now I have linked up that House bill that he mentioned. It's H.R. 3445, Weather Mitigation Research and Technology Transfer Authorization Act of 2007. Mark Udall tried this last year. And he's trying again. Weather Mitigation Research and Technology Transfer Authorization Act of 2007 establishes in the Department of Commerce the Weather Mitigation Advisory and Research Board to promote and fund research and development, studies and investigations with respect to 1. Improved forecast and decision-making technologies for weather mitigation operations, including tailored computer workstations and software and new observation systems with remote sensors, and 2. Assessments and evaluations of the efficacy of weather mitigation, both purposeful, including cloud seeding operations, and inadvertent, including downwind effects and anthropogenic effects. They're fucking with the weather. They have been for decades. Tesla knew about it. I also have linked up, again, Wikipedia's. They've got the chemtrail conspiracy theory. And it goes over all of it. And they talk about weather control, military purposes, scientific study, biological warfare, hegemonic mind control, and occult purposes. And you can read about HAARP and cloud seeding. And you know that China is cloud seeding to make sure they have good weather for the Olympics coming up. But let's move on. Let's move to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. 9/11 airport security pariah tries a comeback. He was the perfect villain. That's the way Frank Argenbright Jr., starched, coiffed, and rich, saw it then, and it's the way he sees it now. Firefighters were digging through the rubble of Ground Zero, and a terrorized nation was demanding an accounting when the focus turned to Argenbright Security, the gigantic airport company that the Atlanta businessmen founded. 6 years ago, Argenbright was a pariah. 2 of the 4 hijacking teams passed through screening stations manned by Argenbright Security. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft later called a press conference to condemn the company for an astonishing pattern of crimes that could have directly jeopardized public safety. And of course, we know that John Ashcroft was warned about flying before 9/11 and stopped. And hopefully we'll get to a little bit of confrontation with John Ashcroft at the end of the show. Jump into Paul Thompson's 9/11 timeline, cooperativeresearch.org. There's a good Argenbright entry. Dateline, Washington, of course, September 11th, 2001, weapons found on additional planes. Inside jobs, question mark? Later in the day, weapons are found planted on board 3 other U.S. airplanes. A U.S. official says of the hijacking, quote, "These look like inside jobs," end quote. Time magazine reports, sources tell Time that U.S. officials are investigating whether the hijackers had accomplices deep inside the airports. Penetrating airport security does not appear to have been that difficult. Argenbright, the company in charge of security at all the airports used by the 9/11 hijackers, had virtually no security check on any of their employees and even hired criminals and illegal immigrants. Security appears to have particularly been abysmal at Boston's Logan Airport, even after 9/11, that coming from the Boston Globe and CNN. And so there's more links, and you can read all about Argenbright and all their connections. And we're going to move on again to the Associated Press, again to military.com. DODI's space-based energy source. Dateline Bali, Indonesia. While great nations fretted over coal, oil, and global warming, one of the smallest at the UN climate conference was looking toward the heavens for its energy. The annual meeting's corridors can be a sounding board for unlikely solutions to climate change, from filling the skies with soot to block the sun to cultivating oceans of seaweed to absorb the atmosphere's heat-trapping carbon dioxide. Unlike other ideas, however, one this year had an influential backer, the Pentagon, which is investigating whether space-based solar power beaming energy down from satellites will provide affordable, clean, safe, reliable, sustainable, and expandable energy for mankind. We'd like to look at it. So the DOD this October quietly issued a 75-page study conducted for its National Security Space Office, concluding that space power, collection of energy by vast arrays of solar panels aboard mammoth satellites, offers a potential energy source for global U.S. military operations. It could be done with today's technology. Of course it could have. And is, and will be. Jumping to USA Today and Dateline Joppa, Maryland, J-O-P-P-A, schools homeland security studies get noticed. And this is basically the Ministry of Homeland Security indoctrinating the 9/11 generation. These are basically kids who were quite young when 9/11 happened and are, of course, traumatized and, of course, being herded into the future of homeland security fields. Which, of course, is the best growing field out there. You know, I hear ads for it on Air America all the time. Call it vocational education for the 9/11 generation. The nation's first comprehensive high school homeland security program, a three-year course to help kids land jobs in the growing anti-terrorism industry, is in its infancy in Maryland, but it's recently been attracting the attention of educators in school districts from as far away as California and Florida. The program started at Maryland's Joppatown High School, and I link to their website, with 61 sophomores, provides, quote, an opportunity for kids to see relevance to being in school. It gives kids additional options. Sure it does. Here's a strange zigzag. UPI, the Moonies. Britain set to release secret UFO files. Dateline London, the British government will soon release previously classified details regarding hundreds of reported sightings of unidentified flying objects. The Sunday Telegraph said last Sunday that this coming spring, the Defense Ministry will release to the general public 160 files about alleged UFO sightings. Since the British government department began keeping records about the unusual reports in 1950, more than 10,000 sightings have been recorded. There's another article up on the Telegraph, MOD to open British UFO X-Files. It's more of the same thing. I'm not exactly interested in all that, but it's there for you on MediaMonarchy.com. Now from the WashingtonTimes.com. Oh, that's the Moonies too, I think. Archives, treasure hunt. Government institutions hardly ever get starring roles in family movies. However, the National Archives found popularity when National Treasure was released 3 years ago. With the sequel, National Treasure Book of Secrets, in theaters, the Archives is jumping on the movie's premise that documents and history go hand in hand with adventure and mystery.
What is it about treasure that makes history so fascinating?
Benjamin Gates has spent a lifetime hunting treasures that have been lost to history.
Take a look at this.
But when a secret from the past is uncovered...
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you one of the missing pages from the diary of John Wilkes Booth.
History will be rewritten.
It's the names of the Lincoln conspirators.
Thomas Gates.
Your great-great-granddaddy planned the assassination.
It can't be.
We cannot have him remembered as a conspirator in the assassination of the man who brought this nation together.
Now.
I need to see the page.
We have 30 seconds to disable the alarm. Go.
You do that in 15 seconds.
That's why I tell people to get a dog.
His search to clear his family's name.
Take a look at this.
It's a cipher.
Clever.
Has uncovered a secret he never expected to find.
There is a book, and it has the information you need. The President's Book of Secrets. A collection of documents for President's eyes only. The truth behind the JFK conspiracy. The missing minutes from the Watergate tapes. And of course, Area 51.
It contains all of our nation's secrets. I need to see the President's book.
The only way you'll ever see that book is if you get elected President.
I'm gonna kidnap him. I'm gonna kidnap the President of the United States.
Wouldn't it just been easier for us to make an appointment?
Code one! Code one!
Gates.
Don't kid yourself what we're capable of.
Every clue leads one step closer.
A letter sent by the Queen.
You're in danger.
You've got to find wherever that leads before they do.
To unlocking the mystery. The world isn't ready to believe.
Ben, wait. That could be a horrible trap.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
National Treasure, Book of Secrets.
Oh, look, my tax dollars at work coming to arrest me.
Oh, you gotta love it when Disney and Bruckheimer get together for some phony Illuminati propaganda. And there's links up for you to read about Book of Secrets and the Abraham Lincoln assassination and all that stuff. Staying on the tip of Hollywood propaganda, this coming from Press TV, Hollywood to frame Iran for Lockerbie. Hollywood and Israel join hands to blame Iran for masterminding the Lockerbie disaster in a new cinematic adaptation of the event. The film will be based on a book by Yuval Aviv, who we've gone over on this show before, former supposed Mossad agent and amazing predictor of terrorist attacks. The former Israeli secret agent and a top investigator for Pan American during the Lockerbie inquiry. And according to Scotland on Sunday, Flight 103, that's the name of the movie, will hit the market on January 24th. That seems unlikely to me because I couldn't find anything about this movie online. Flight 103. But it accuses Iranian and American secret services of involvement in the incident. The former Mossad agent has negotiated the film rights with a number of high-profile Hollywood directors, including the acclaimed Steven Spielberg, who had hired him as a consultant in 2005 for his award-winning film Munich. Lockerbie is a town located in southwestern Scotland, which is internationally known as the wreckage site of Pan Am Flight 103, which crashed on December 21, 1988, as a result of a terrorist bombing. In 1991, Libyan intelligence agent Ali Mohammed al-Megrahi was charged with planning the bomb and was sentenced to life imprisonment in January 2001. Now, I got a lot of links and a lot of stuff on the Lockerbie story. Jumping to the aforementioned Scotland on Sunday, that basically reiterates what we just said. Yuval Aviv is shopping his latest bit around. However, let's jump more importantly to an article by Robert Fisk, and it's up on independent.co.uk. Do you know the truth about Lockerbie? I urge anyone who is aware of government lies over Flight 103 to come forward. This is from Robert Fisk, who we mentioned, and he references it here in the first sentence. After writing about the ravers who regularly turn up at lectures to claim that President Bush, the CIA, the Pentagon, Mossad, etc., perpetrated the crimes of 9/11, I received a letter this week from Marion Irvine, who feared that members of her family run the risk of being just such ravers and voices heard in the wilderness. Far from it. For Ms. Irvine was writing about Lockerbie, and like her, I believe there are many dark and sinister corners to this atrocity. I'm not at all certain that the CIA did not have a scam drug heist on board, and I am not at all sure that the diminutive Libyan agent Megrahi, ultimately convicted on the evidence of the memory of a Maltese tailor, really arranged to plant the bomb on board Pan Am Flight 103 in December 98. Now, something jumping back a few months ago, this coming from Reuters. This was in my, you know, bookmarked log. And so when I was posting up this thing about Hollywood and Israel to blame Iran, dug in. This coming from Reuters. Lockerbie lawyers demand secret foreign evidence. Lawyers for a Libyan man convicted of the 88 Lockerbie airline bombing demanded access on Thursday to evidence from an unnamed foreign state, Israel, which they believe could undermine the case against him. So that's posted up. The Pan Am Flight 103 Wikipedia entry is there, and you can read all about it. It was a clipper made of the seas. There's also the alternative theories of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, and that's everything from CIA and Lockerbie, Iran and the PFLP, Iran and the London angle, Libya and Abu Nidal, CIA protected suitcase theory, the radio detonation, and all the flaws and accusations and attempts to reopen the case. There's also, and we mentioned the Maltese Taylor, there is a 2.5-hour documentary up on Google Video in its entirety. It's called The Maltese Double Cross. It's a documentary about the Lockerbie bombing, produced, written, and directed by Alan Frankovich. It came out in November 94. Of course, it was never widely distributed, but it stirred up quite the bit of controversy. I have not made it all the way through this documentary, but let's listen to a quick clip of it now.
In February 1990, with some others from the UK Families Group, I met the American President's Commission on Aviation Security and Terrorism at the American Embassy. That was in February 1990. And at the end of that meeting, after we'd broken up, one of the members of the commission said to me, "Your government and ours know exactly what happened, but they're never going to tell."
In the beginning, a hand, a bag, and a baggage tag. And a radio that plays cassettes and has its own flip side, a bomb.
Maltese Double Cross in its entirety, posted up on Google Video and MediaMonarchy.com. We got to move quick. I don't know if I have... Yeah, I can't stay on Lockerbie anymore, but you should dive into it. It, of course, like all the others, was an inside job. Jumping to roguegovernment.com, Northcom basically says that the Constitution's not important. This coming, of course, from Lee Rogers. The United States government is now actively directing the attention of the U.S. military towards the American people. Using the phony war on terror, the Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Northern Command, NORTHCOM, are creating a militarized control grid specifically to enslave the American people. One thing is clear, neither of these agendas abide by the Constitution. In fact, both agencies by themselves are unconstitutional and should be abolished. Despite this, it's expected that they would at least try to follow the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution, regardless of the unconstitutionality of the institutions themselves. And so this dives into a press release on what NORTHCOM is up to. And I have linked up the NORTHCOM entry on sourcewatch.org. It's headquartered at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and it was established in 2002 by the DoD to consolidate under a single unified command existing missions that were previously executed by other military organizations. The centralization of power, which we've already seen through the previous 90 minutes. Returning to the torture tapes and the 9/11 Commission, thinkprogress.org review finds CIA withheld tapes from the 9/11 Commission. They point out that the New York Times reports that a, quote, review of classified documents by former members of the 9/11 Commission shows that the panel made repeated and detailed requests to the CIA in 2003 and 4 for documents and other information about the interrogation of suspects. In interviews this week, the two chairmen of the commission, Lee Hamilton and Thomas Keene, Hess Oil, said their reading of the report had convinced them that the agency had made a conscious decision to impede the 9/11 Commission's inquiry. Mr. Keene, a Republican and former governor of New Jersey, said the agency's decision not to disclose the existence of the videotapes, quote, "I don't know whether that's illegal or not, but it's certainly wrong." Mr. Hamilton, a former Democratic congressman from Indiana, said that the CIA, quote, clearly obstructed, end quote, the commission's investigation. Last Wednesday, New York Times reported that at least four top White House lawyers, including Harriet Myers, Alberto Gonzalez, and others, had discussed with the CIA whether or not to destroy the tapes. And I think those others include, of course, David Addington. I have linked up Mark Mazzetta's New York Times article, 9/11 panel study finds that the CIA withheld tapes. And they mention, of course, Zelikow and Mukasey and McConnell and Spector and waterboarding. There's another one with Scott Shane and Mark Mazzetti. Bush lawyers discussed fate of CIA tapes. And that's Negroponte and the ACLU with corrections appended. But let's jump to Cryptagon. FBI prepares vast biometrics database. Yes, they want to scan and track you at all times. But you're going to fall out of your chair when you read that the FBI is building its systems according to standards shared by Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. So let's get it straight. The countries that run Echelon, the largest civilian communications surveillance program in the world, have developed unified standards for biometric identification. There's a running hypothesis that the plan is to physically track each individual's position on the ground at all times. In an article, AT&T invents programming language for mass surveillance. Cryptagon speculated that the mobile phone data might be the way it's being done. Well, we don't need to speculate anymore. That's what they want to do. Washington Post article blurts it all out quite plainly. Unfortunately, jumping to my home state of West Virginia, and there's a massive, one of the biggest biometrics firms there. At the West Virginia University Center for Identification Technology Research, 45 minutes north of the FBI's biometric facility in Clarksburg, researchers are working on capturing images of people's irises at distances of up to 15 feet and of faces from as far away as 200 yards. And soon those researchers will do biometric research for the FBI. Covert iris and face image capture is several years away, but it is of great interest to government agencies. So back to Cryptagon. In other words, once you've been declared an enemy of the state, there will be no way to hide, and you won't even see the eye scanners. The Reuters article, FBI aims for world's largest biometrics database, lets you know that, you know, this isn't the wacky conspiracy sites making it up. Reuters says the FBI is embarking on a $1 billion project to build the world's largest computer database of biometrics to give the government more ways to identify people at home and abroad. More ways. We mentioned Echelon. Sourcewatch.org has quite the posting on it. Echelon is a term associated with a global network of computers that automatically search through millions of intercepted messages for pre-programmed keywords or fax, telex, and email addresses. Every word of every message in the frequencies and channels selected at a station is automatically searched. The processors in the network are known as the Echelon dictionaries. Echelon connects all these computers and allows the individual stations to function as distributed elements in an integrated system. An Echelon station's dictionary consists not only of its parent agency's chosen keywords, but also lists for each of the four other agencies in the UK-USA system, NSA, and all the other alphabets that I've never even heard of, frighteningly enough. So the SourceWatch article goes into how Echelon works, is everyone else doing what Echelon does, and so on and so forth. Moving back to 9/11, and we're going to dive in a little deeper on this one. This coming from the AP, suspect is kin to 9/11 hijacker. Dateline San Juan, Puerto Rico, a Saudi terrorism suspect facing possible charges before a military tribunal at Guantanamo has been identified as a brother-in-law of one of the 9/11 hijackers. Ahmed Mohammed Ahmed Haza al-Darbi, who is accused of helping to organize an al-Qaeda plot to attack a ship, is a brother-in-law of Khalid al-Midar, a Saudi who was one of the hijackers who crashed a plane into the Pentagon. But he wasn't the one who did it, remember? Al-Darbi, 32, faces possible charges that include conspiracy and providing support to terrorism and could be sentenced to up to life in prison if convicted by the military tribunal. Prosecutors have drawn up the charges and informed the detainee of the accusations against... Wow, they actually told him what he was accused of. That's not very Kafka trial-like of them. The military says al-Darbi was a trained al-Qaeda operative who met with Osama bin Laden and helped organize a plot to attack a ship off Yemen or in the Straits of Hormuz. The military did not say whether his relationship with al-Madar is connected to the accusations against him. Al-Madar and another hijacker lived in San Diego before they boarded American Airlines Flight 77 on 9/11 as part of a team that crashed it into the Pentagon, killing 190 people on the ground and on the plane. Now, let's read about al-Darbi quickly. Citizen of Saudi Arabia, held in extrajudicial detention in the United States Guantanamo Bay detainment camp. He was born January 9th, 1975, in Saudi Arabia. And it goes into his status and the review board and all that dirt and the teams he was supposedly involved with. Let's jump, however, once again to Paul Thompson's complete 9/11 timeline, cooperative research. June 13, 2001, hijacker al-Madar obtains U.S. visa despite incorrect passport and lies on application, even though U.S. intelligence knows he is an al-Qaeda operative. Hijacker Khalid al-Madar obtains a second U.S. visa from the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. His passport, which was issued 2 weeks previously, lacks an expiration date but contains an indicator of possible terrorist affiliation. His application form is incomplete as it lists his occupation as businessman but does not give his employer's name and address. The application form, which is submitted through the Visa Express program, meaning he's not interviewed, contains two lies. He says he's never received an American visa or traveled to the U.S., whereas he received a visa in 99 and traveled to the U.S. on it in 2000. As al-Madar's first visa was also issued by the Jeddah consulate, through which the CIA sent radical Arabs to the U.S. for training during the Soviet-Afghan War. Consular officials could discover he is lying, but information about prior visas issuances is not automatically displayed to them. So basically, 11 of the 14 visas issued to the hijackers in Jeddah are issued by the same consular office, but it is unclear whether this visa is issued by that officer or another one. So basically, as we've said, we knew who the hijackers were. There were FBI agents that tried to stop them, and they were stopped themselves. I played a clip from it when it first came out. It's worth repeating and diving into a little bit of Flight 77 and Khalid al-Madar and the amazing, amazing pilot who actually supposedly crashed the plane into the Pentagon, Hani Hanjour. Here's a clip from Final Cut of Loose Change.
And in terms of what motivated me to bring all the aircraft down, as you see one thing happen, that's an accident. When you see two of the same thing occur, it's a pattern. But when you see three of the same thing occur, it's a program. And so at that point, I decided to bring all the aircraft down.
And so, at 9:45, all airborne planes were forced to land. This order applied to all civilian aircraft. Certain military planes were allowed to remain airborne. By 12:16 that afternoon, the FAA managed to ground over 4,000 planes without incident.
During the time that the airplane coming in to the Pentagon, there was a young man who would come in and say to the vice president, the plane is 50 miles out, the plane is 30 miles out. And when it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, do the orders still stand? And the vice president turned and whipped his neck around and said, of course the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary?
Arlington, Virginia. American Airlines Flight 77 allegedly crashes into the ground floor of the Pentagon. Pentagon authorities will deny that the building had anti-aircraft defense. The FBI arrives within minutes, and the site is declared a federal crime scene, becoming their exclusive responsibility. With the help of civilians, they combed the Pentagon lawn for debris, and within 24 hours, they had confiscated every known video of the attack. Pentagon officials initially denied that any of their cameras captured the event. However, on March 7, 2002, five images taken by a security camera from across the heliport are released. For years, these five frames were the only public footage of the Pentagon attack. This would change on October 14, 2004, when Scott Bingham would file a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit requesting videotapes that captured the impact of Flight 77. Special Agent Jacqueline McGuire of the FBI located a CD-ROM that contains copies of two time-lapse recordings made by security cameras, released on March 16, 2006. A video taken from a Citgo gas station, which is open only to Pentagon employees, released on September 15, 2006. And the DoubleTree Hotel in Arlington, Virginia, released on December 7, 2006. Agent McGuire concluded that the FBI possessed 85 videotapes that might be potentially responsive. As of this date, we have no clear images of what happened at the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11.
That's just a little bit of Loose Change diving into the Pentagon attack, and they basically go in and go on to talk about Hani Hanjour, about how all his flight instructors said he was a waste of resources and couldn't pilot a Cessna. Somehow, a month later, was able to pull off the masterful maneuvers and hit the Pentagon. Jumping now to Raw Story, this caught my eye. Former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover sought to suspend habeas corpus and imprison thousands. According to newly declassified document, the New York Times reports a plan by former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover sought to suspend habeas corpus during wartime with the intention of imprisoning thousands of Americans indefinitely. Hoover's plan was submitted to the White House 12 days after the start of the Korean War. Under the plan, approximately 12,000 people deemed as potentially dangerous to national security, 97% of whom were American citizens, would have been rounded up and sent to military prisons without due process. And I have that full New York Times article linked up. Now, we're going to blast through a whole bunch of stuff that I bookmarked through December. It's the December clearinghouse. Here's a good one. West Virginia cop says woman wiped her nose on him. A woman in Charleston was charged with battery on a police officer after the officer said she wiped her nose on the back of his shirt. And that's posted up under The Strange on the Examiner. Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, is paying $4.5 billion to buy up some of Chicago. And we also have the Church of Scientology buying up downtown Detroit. That's coming from BewareOfThis.info. We've also got Jeb Bush going for a little private visit to Israel. That coming from the Jerusalem Post. 2 weeks before, U.S. President George W. Bush is scheduled to arrive on his first visit to Israel as president. His younger brother, Jeb Bush, is scheduled to arrive Monday for a private visit. And we'll see how that goes. Jumping to Reuters, the White House tour, their little Christmas tour, they omit the very rare JFK 1963 Christmas card. One of the stops on this year's popular White House tour of holiday decorations is the collection of Christmas cards from previous presidents and first ladies, but noticeably missing is the card from 1963. It's the rarest and most tragic of the presidential cards because it was not sent out after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas that November 22nd. And if you hit that link, you can see the photo that's used on that Christmas card. Jumping once again to Cryptogon.com, IBM building a metaverse, and they talk about a book called Snow Crash, which my man Zach has always been a fan of, and now this lets me know I should probably check it out. But via Network World, IBM is building a virtual world to help its employees collaborate. And while it's not the first big technology company to do so, Big Blue may be unusual in that it decided not to mess with those silly laws of physics in its own virtual environment. So, charting new territory in inner space and outer space. You probably heard of this, of course, this coming from WFTV.com. 35-year-old woman tasered in front of all the customers at Best Buy because, basically, they said her credit card didn't work. And she got angry because she knew that it did work. I think she got a little indignant, and they tased her. And, of course, it turned out it was Best Buy's fault, and her card was fine. Jerry Mazza has another great article posted up on onlinejournal.com. This one's 9/11's History of Tragic Events, writing December 14th. Jerry Mazza writes, "In retrospect, how strange is it that on September 11th, 1973, President Salvador Allende of Chile, the world's first democratically elected Marxist president, died either by suicide or murder in a coordinated revolt by army leaders. The attack was carried out on the presidential palace with planes, rockets, bombs, and tanks after Allende rejected a demand to resign. The coup was led by human piranha General Augusto Pinochet, who went on to rule the country with an iron fist for almost 17 years, meeting his maker on December 10th, 2006. Ironically, 28 years later, on the same day, September 11, 2001, we saw the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacked, Flight 93 crash in Pennsylvania, and the incidents left nearly 3,000 dead. Now, Chile's military junta claims fewer than 100 people died, but Pinochet's regime, in fact, exercised its brutal muscle during his reign to torture and murder some 3,000 souls, jail 27,000 more without trial, and send thousands more fleeing the country for asylum. Above and beyond these similarities of events, the Chilean coup was engineered by who? Heinz Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon, and Richard Helms, all of the CIA, or rather Helms of the CIA. The CIA admitted all this as much on September 11th, 1998. And there's more there, and it talks about 911 and the phone number being used and then reused and then shelved. Moving on, hitting Ron Paul yet again. He made an appearance on Mad Money with Jim Cramer. So let's listen to Jim Cramer scream for a second.
Who's running for president as a Republican and has been highly critical of the Federal Reserve. I'm inviting all the candidates to swing through Mad Money to talk about your money. Congressman Paul's position is so important on the Fed, and his method of spreading his message for his campaign is so different from everyone else's that we're thrilled to have him on the show tonight. Welcome, Congressman Paul.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you. Look, one of the things that's changed, and you're changing it, caucuses and kissing babies, they don't cut it anymore on the campaign trail. This is 2007. YouTube is king in so many ways. I never thought we would have so much in common, Congressman Paul, but you and I have struck a chord and become YouTube sensations. And it's about an unlikely topic. It's about the Federal Reserve. And we know even the younger people are into it. Why is it that your message, my message, somewhat critical, absolutely critical of the Fed, is just reaching home to so many young people and actually everyone throughout the country?
Well, to me, it's utterly amazing. When I go to the college campuses, I get the loudest applause when I criticize the Fed and indicate that I don't even like the Fed and think we should talk about getting rid of it. So it is an important issue, and I think this is the first time in over 100 years that it's become an issue in a presidential campaign. So I'm really excited about it because the monetary issue is something that has driven me to get involved in politics for a long time.
Now, you have been, I think, spot on in saying that the Federal Reserve created the stock bubble with low margin rates, and it created the housing bubble with low mortgage rates. Yet I never hear about anyone talking about investigating the Fed in Congress. It's a creature of Congress. Why don't we do it?
You're absolutely right. That's why I introduce a bill constantly to audit the Federal Reserve. We've created the Federal Reserve, and it has no oversight. We don't even know if they have the gold there anymore. And it's so important, yet there's no oversight. I think it's even more secret than the CIA. So to me, it ought to be open, and the American people ought to know. But unfortunately, the members of Congress don't have much interest or concern or understanding of how the Fed works, so they are totally neglectful.
That was Jim Cramer and Ron Paul.
Okay, I'm going to move on. I mentioned this several times on the show, but I finally got to it. A CIA torture jet crashed, and what did it have on board? Can you take a guess?
A Gulfstream jet that crash-landed in Mexico in late September bearing a load of nearly 4 tons of cocaine was used by the CIA for trips between the U.S. and Guantanamo Bay. But that's just the tip of the iceberg.
I speak as a retired international covert operative for the Drug Enforcement Administration. What we're uncovering here through the hard and courageous work of journalist Bill Conroy is something nobody, Central Intelligence, FBI, they don't want this out there. They don't want anybody peeking under the rugs that Mark is talking about this plane crash carrying 4 tons of cocaine. Any kind of corruption you could imagine occurs. And when you talk about 4 tons of cocaine coming into the United States with the involvement of a man who worked as a pilot for CIA, DEA, and FBI, who was obviously somebody who was a shaker and a mover, his jet crashed in late September of this year in the Yucatan. It had about 4 tons of coke on it, and it flew out of Fort Lauderdale to Mexico, and from Mexico to Colombia. Rio Negro, Colombia, is where it took off from, which is just outside of Medellin. And, it obviously picked up the coke in Colombia and was headed back toward our neck of the woods. Yeah, and that's the route. Right. It was gonna land at an airport, again in the Yucatan, probably from what I've been able to gather, loaded down with that much cocaine and had to refuel.
Yeah, exactly.
But as they said, someone didn't grease the deal right. In the airport they were going to land at, there was a ship change, and they wouldn't let them land. So they went to another airport, tried to land, it wouldn't land there, and they basically got stranded in the air, ran out of fuel, and had to ditch it. And that's how they got caught. So it was a deal that went bad, apparently. What's come out on it so far is the jet that they were flying, we got the FAA records on it, and the Europeans have been looking into the rendition flights that the CIA, the agency, was running for Guantanamo. And these tail numbers on this jet that crashed show up in some of their research as being used, this jet being used for at least 3 flights to Guantanamo between 03 and 05.
Now, that's coming, amazingly enough, the posting, anyway, from Daily Kos. CIA. So who knows what all that's about, but all the links and all the info is there for you. There's a video I'm not going to play a clip from, but it's the truth about the Bali bombings, and of course asking Ki Bono who benefited. The Bali bombings were a direct U.S.-Israeli response to the growing peace marches and anti-war movements in Australia that were ballooning at alarming rate after 9/11. And all that's there for you. It's a 10-parter up on YouTube. I mentioned Huckabee, that we'd get back into him. Here's just a little quick touch. BlacklistedNews.com, their headline, proof that Huckabee is bought and paid for.
Tonight, his record on ethics as governor and what our senior investigative correspondent Lisa Myers found to be an unusual record of receiving gifts.
Thank you, sir.
There's an old saying that it's better to give than to receive. But as governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee seemed to like receiving a lot. Financial disclosure forms revealed that over 10 years, Huckabee and his wife took hundreds of gifts, large and small, more than $112,000 worth in 1 year alone. Guitars, gold jewelry and diamonds, vacations, gift certificates, free dental care and dry cleaning, $23,000 for Mrs. Huckabee's inaugural wardrobe, and 50% off hamburgers at Wendy's.
50% off hamburgers at Wendy's. Sweet. Yeah, I'll become the governor of Arkansas. Moving quickly, the AP has a story. Botched terror raid terrorizes Minnesota family. Another incorrect terror raid. Blogger News Network has Defense Intelligence Agency document confirms Osama bin Laden's plans to penetrate the U.S. biodefense. Washington Post has UN finds fraud and mismanagement in peacekeeping, and that's more UN scandals in Congo and Haiti, which of course will always ultimately tie into DynCorp and their sex slavery rings and all that garbage. Reuters has a report. The New York Times Interact says Blackwater shot our dog. The U.S. Embassy in Iraq is investigating another deadly shooting incident involving its Blackwater bodyguards. This time, the New York Times' dog. That story's there. Mark Crispin Miller, .blogspot.com, news from underground. There's a rather audio clips, but I don't have time to play them. But basically, the ex-governor of Alabama says that the 02 election was stolen from him by the White House, and it connects to Karl Rove and, of course, their favorite no paper trail voting machines. The LA Times has an article that basically says that precious metals, gold, platinum, silver, are havens for survivalists, conspiracy theorists, and flakes. RadarOnline.com has Bush shredding soaring, and it has a little chart that shows the amount of documents they've shredded over the course of the 7 years, and it only goes up and up and up and up and up. USAspending.gov, and you can learn more. NYMag.com has a funny one about the 10 best movie destructions of New York City, and we've seen a lot more and more of this lately. Of course, it was taboo after 9/11, but now it's coming back full swing. And they go through Godzilla and Ghostbusters 2 and artificial intelligence and The Siege, which of course is about martial law in America, Armageddon, King Kong, Gangs of New York, Day After Tomorrow, Deep Impact, and of course Independence Day. And of course the lead into all that is I Am Legend and Clover Field or whatever that's called. MalaysiaSun.com mentions, did Morgan Spurlock find Osama bin Laden? Documentary filmmaker Morgan Spurlock from my home state of West Virginia. His latest documentary, Where in the World is Osama bin Laden, has sparked speculations if the director has found the most wanted man in the world. That kind of smells of a psyop to me, but we'll see. MonstersandCritics.com has Muslim man helps Jews attacked on New York subway. JBS.org, yes, the John Birch Society, they're asking the musical question, why has the U.S. Forest Service purchased $600,000 worth of tasers? Time, going into Matthew Murray and the Colorado shooting, did gunmen warn of second attack? Was the FBI warned of an attack? The AP wonders. Jumping back to Press TV, American Jews oppose war on Iran. The annual survey of the American Jewish community has indicated that as much as 57% of U.S. Jews are against a military attack on Iran. And there's another poll that says U.S. Jews turning against Israel, where basically the support for the state of Israel is going down and down and down. The Guardian has central banks joining forces in a move to tackle the credit crunch, which basically means them punching up more zeros and ones to stay afloat. Paul Ehrlich has an article, and Brent Jessup, rather, up on knowledge-driven revolution, how to control the American population. And then we also, dovetailing in with that, elite depopulation agenda gains ground, that coming from Steve Watson. And that basically ties into the depopulation and eugenics. Christopher Hitchens, he of The Trial of Henry Kissinger, has an article up on Slate.com, abolish the CIA, destroying the interrogation tapes amounts to mutiny and treason. We've got Zymorfa's article up on thepeoplesvoice.org, proof of the war between the establishments, which basically says, yes, of course, there's two and more battling ruling elites, and some are saying, yeah, let's go, 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 and the others are saying, whoa, slow down, we want one world government, but you're going to blow the whole thing. There's another report of toxic fumes over the Dimona reactor in Israel, so we don't know what's going on there. Time also has a great article, great if you can read into it, about the Fort Dix conspiracy. There's also a little podcast. I was going to play a clip, but I don't have time. The Fort Dix thing was basically, you know, another case of provocateur terror where you take retarded Patsy Dupe street kid wannabes and give them a bunch of money and give them a bunch of cameras and give them a bunch of guns and say, yeah, you should say Allah Akbar. And they do, and they get arrested, and it's phony bullshit. Israel considering attack on Iran. We've also got psychotropic drug prescriptions to children skyrocket 400% in 10 years. That coming from NewsTarget.com. We've got Reporters Without Borders reporting that more than 100 websites blocked in growing wave of online censorship. And that also ties in with Syria blocking tons and tons of websites, not only Facebook, but tons more. Tech.co.uk has invite Big Brother into your house. Of course, you know, you can bring in a monitor. You can have an electronic monitor that's there that the police can watch while you're away from home. Colombian.com, again, mentions the Omaha gunman freed from centers and homes where, of course, he was fed lots of psychotropic drugs and God knows what else. ParallelNormal.com has reporters, or rather travelers, love being scanned. It's so fast and easy. Raw Story and AP has the FBI saying that a Guantanamo detainee was with Osama bin Laden. This was Salim Ahmed Hamdan. So more claims of boogie bin Laden. Iris scans let law enforcement keep eye on criminals. I think we kind of covered that. Resist and Revolt has a good one. And according to Google Trends, if the election happened today, Ron Paul would be the next U.S. president. And they predicted it the last time. Chinese dissidents establish transitional mainland government. That coming from the Epoch Times. You can get your mercury and formaldehyde flu shot at the airport. That coming from the AP and Kurt Nimmo. There was a dirty bomb exercise in Mobile, Alabama. And Good Morning America has a good clip. This is a nice one. This is, you know, reporting 101 that maybe you should know the answer to the question before you ask it.
Then a surprising assessment that shows the distance between our political cultures. When I asked about Osama bin Laden's latest audio tape, one of them answered with a question of her own.
Who is Osama bin Laden? He's just a character created by America.
Well, actually, 98% of Pakistan would probably follow along the same line. They believe that Osama is basically a CIA agent who is working undercover to put a bad image of Islam.
Really? Yeah. So that there is no Osama bin Laden.
A lot of them find it difficult to believe that such Muslims could actually exist.
We could all drive an hour from where we are right now and find many, many people who stand by what Osama bin Laden says in the spirit of Islam.
To be quite honest, that's a very marginalized section of Pakistani society. Islamic extremism that you find here did not really exist in Pakistan pre-9/11 or pre the Musharraf government.
So, yeah, that's people on Good Morning America dropping a little surprise to Chris Cuomo. What do you think of bin Laden? He's a CIA bullshit creation. What? Jumping to my man Michael Vail at thought-criminal.org. U.S. seeks probe after Putin's poll victory. Are you fucking kidding me? Dateline Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin won a big endorsement in a parliamentary election at the 3rd of December, but the United States urged Moscow to investigate opposition charges of widespread vote fraud. Isn't that fucking rich? And finally, I mentioned we were going to get to a little bit of John Ashcroft confrontation. This is kind of ugly.
Our system was fine. We did catch the hijackers. We were surveillancing them, and they're lying to you. They're trying to tell you our system can't do this. Well, the truth is, granting special powers is one thing, but taking away rights is another. They can't do their job and go to a court and say, this is our evidence, this guy's clearly this, and grant a special privilege to go after him, then they're not doing their job right. It's not your liberties that are the problem. It's the fact that they don't want to admit that they do a half-assed job, and they don't investigate people like this, and they gag Sybil Edmonds, and they ruin Anthony Schaefer's life, and they're crooks, and they're phonies, and it's bull.
Murderer!
Please tell us about Sybil Edmonds. John! John, talk about Sybil Edmonds!
Oh, that's We Are Change Colorado letting the eagle soar up on John Ashcroft. And damn, that's going to do it. I made it through hundreds of pages of news somehow. Like I said, I don't actually have a bunch of hits because I didn't get a whole bunch of traffic last week. Except for, of course, like I said, the DEA and great hits from Dig and also Little Green Footballs because of the Daily Call CIA article I had posted up. But that's going to do it for episode 56 of Media Monarchy. December 28th, 2007, and that's going to do it for this first full year of MediaMonarchy.com. coming to you live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and Monday nights at 5 Eastern time from the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.info. I implore you to hit me up on MySpace and Yahoo and Facebook and all those things with Media Monarchy as your keyword, iTunes Radio for all.net and archive.org. Have the podcast almost anytime. So, like I said to maybe all those folks who joined on last week, I welcome you aboard. I'm glad you're here. I hope you stay with me. Send me an email, put up a link, pass the show along, keep doing it, because 2008 is going to be one to remember. And I'll be here next week for you and every week on MediaMonarchy.com. So, like I say, like my man, Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.